Morning, everyone. Glad to be here. I'm going to be talking about the academic achievement gap. And both the health disparity gap and the achievement gap has persisted for a long time in the United States. And no matter how effectively teachers can teach, no matter how rigorous curricula in schools are, no matter how we reorganize schools or what kinds of assessments or standards we put in place, all these different efforts are going to be jeopardized if the students are not motivated and able to learn. Something I've called educationally relevant health disparities have powerful but largely overlooked effects on students' motivation and ability to learn. So, as Dr. Cook said, there are these strong reciprocal causal relationships between health and education, as well as on underlying social and economic factors. And I'm glad to see that our public health sector, thanks in no small part to my colleague on my far left there, has really recognized the importance of education as a way to improve public health in the nation. What I'm going to be talking about this morning is how certain health factors really have direct and powerful effects on academic achievement and on educational attainment, and try to encourage people in the education sector to pay more attention to these factors. It's important to note, as Dr. Koh did, I think, that when we look at the population of youth in the United States that have the greatest health disparities, and the greatest academic disparities, and the greatest economic disparities, it's the same population. So therefore, it really behooves us to concentrate resources where they're needed most. Now, schools can't do it alone. Again, as Dr. Koh said, we need to rely on the other social institutions within our society, family, media, government, healthcare, solidarity groups, organizations to play their part, but schools are where youth are, and they have a tremendous potential to shape the lives of youth. But they can't do everything. And unfortunately, schools have been somewhat reluctant to fully embrace addressing health as part of their fundamental mission. And it's not surprising. I mean, they're struggling to achieve primary goals of literacy and numeracy and so forth. And, you know, if you're like me, you might think that health, improving children's health, is a valuable goal in and of itself. But if you're a school leader, you might be focused more on the academic issues. So there has to be a way for school leaders to prioritize which health issues to focus on. And I suggest that three criteria are worth consideration. One is the prevalence of the problems and how much they cause disparities. Second is, what's the evidence that these problems causally affect educational outcomes? And thirdly, can we do something about them through school-based programs? And based on those criteria, I identified seven criteria: vision, asthma, teen pregnancy, aggression and violence, physical activity, breakfast, and ADHD, as factors that warrant consideration as priorities for the school. And two things I want to say about this list. First of all, it's not a one-size-fits-all. It doesn't mean that every school should be doing all of these things. There are differences from one place to another. These are more illustrative, to say these are things that are worth considering. And the second thing I want to say about this list is there's an underlying thematic factor of these problems, and that's mental and emotional health. And mental and emotional health either causes or is a consequence of every one of these problems. And I think any effective program in schools will have a strong emphasis on mental and emotional health factors. So all these problems are prevalent. One in five children are affected by visual impairment. Asthma is the most chronic disease affecting youth. About one in three female teens is expected to become pregnant. Almost 30% of high school students report being bullied in the past year. Two out of three don't get enough physical activity. One in five skip breakfast. And ADHD is the most common mental and behavior disorder affecting school-age populations. It's about 4.6 million children we're talking about here. All of these problems also disproportionately affect urban minority populations. Here you see the rates for visual impairment in children age 12 and above. This is actually overall population. This next slide shows asthma prevalence by school-age population. You see compared with whites, blacks are about 45% more likely to have asthma. And that's actually not the problem. The problem is really poorly controlled asthma, which is indicated by overuse of emergency rooms for primary care and underuse of efficacious medications. And you see these same disparities with respect to asthma. These are birth rates. Again, these are data a little bit old. Things have improved since this time, but you see rates for birth rates for black teens are about three times as high compared to whites, and for Latino teens about four times as high. This is 35% of high school students report being in a physical fight in the past year. This is data from 2011 YRBS survey conducted by the Centers for Disease Control. So these data I'm showing are national probability samples. They pertain to really youth throughout America. Again, you see these disparities. And relevant to Bob's presentation, here we see that almost 1 out of 10 Hispanic high school students in America say they've missed one or more days of school in the past month because they were afraid to be at school or to travel to or from school. See significant proportions of high school students, this is females in particular, don't receive enough physical activity, and breakfast consumption is quite variable. You see the gaps persist whether we look at 9-year-olds or 19-year-olds, and ADHD is also more common. Now, among low-income and single mother head of households. Now, sadly, nothing I've said here is new. Everything is old news. These health disparities have persisted for a long time. But the next topic I'm going to talk about is largely based on research in about the last 10, 15 years. And that is how and why do these factors influence educational outcomes? And I've identified these five causal pathways: sensory perceptions, cognition, connectedness and engagement, absenteeism, and dropout. Sensory perception is just being able to see and hear well. That's important for learning. Cognition has to do with things like being able to remember things, pay attention, solve problems, make decisions. Absenteeism is very important, as Bob mentioned, quite predictive as early as sixth grade, and dropout is obviously an important factor. One of the things that's been less appreciated, or at least well documented, is the importance of school connectedness. And school connectedness means the extent to which students in school feel that their peers and the adults in the school really care about them as learners and as people, to the extent that school is a community that you really feel like you belong and want to be. As I'll go through these pathways and talk about how, just give some examples how these different health problems have an effect. So here, you know, we look at vision problems, and mainly the main one's really hyperopia. It affects many of us, and if it doesn't affect you yet, it probably will. It means your inability to see things at close distance. And in New York City, I took a look at data in the 58 lowest performing elementary schools. We found that 25% of the kids failed the vision screening in kindergarten. That wasn't the bad news. The bad news was when we rescreened again in first grade, 60% of those failed again, indicating that they never get the glasses they need. It's not rocket science here. We put an optometrist. We did a study in 8 elementary schools where we put an optometrist in 4 of them. Every child that failed the vision screen automatically got an eye exam. Those that needed glasses got 2 pair, one to keep at school, one to take home. Those glasses cost $12 a pair, and we found that we could double the rate of in-class eyeglass use. For some reason, children with ADHD also have more vision problems. Moving on to cognition, just thinking skills. You see, one of the things I'd like you to notice is there's these multiple problems. 6 of these 7 factors have an effect on cognition. Here, vision problems are not seeing, it's visual motor integration, the connections between our eyes and our brain, being able to see something on the blackboard and write it down. Well, that's very important for succeeding in school. How does asthma affect cognition? Again, it's poorly controlled asthma because it disrupts sleep. And sleep, neuroscientists have recognized the importance of sleep and being able to pay attention and really learn well to your fullest attention. Children in a school with aggression and violence are much more likely to have disrupted thoughts, interruptions. If you're worried, if you're sitting in algebra class worrying about, you know, whether you're going to get beat up after school, it might be a little harder to pay attention. And the Greeks, you know, thousands of years ago, the Greeks knew the connections between our mind and our bodies. It's only really the last 10 years that the neuroscientists have shown how neuronal factors and oxygen saturation in our brain really has powerful effects on us. And school administrators recognize the importance of breakfast because on the day before the test, they tend to send a note home saying, make sure your child gets a good night's sleep and eats a good breakfast. Probably a good idea those 179 other days of school as well. You're trying to learn, and ADHD is, by definition, the symptomology involves impairments in cognition. So school connectedness has affected by all these things. Vision problems, you know, is demoralizing. No matter how hard you try, you can't succeed. You're likely to be disengaged and disconnect. If you go to a school that, you know, is characterized by a lot of hateful graffiti on the walls or there's teasing or bullying, it's not going to be someplace you feel connected to. Physical activity programs not only provide an opportunity for cultivating fitness, but really training, helping young people learn important life skills and be connected to the school, learning how to work together as a team, learning how to win, learning how to lose, learning how to be resilient, learning how to be respectful of others. Phenomenal opportunities, but too often these programs are cut. Sorry, I'm rushing through a little here, but it's not controversial that asthma does cause more absenteeism. We showed the slide, almost one out of 10 Hispanic youth say they miss a day or school in the last month because they're afraid to be at school and so forth. And we know that teen pregnancy is a direct and powerful cause of dropping out of school, and children with ADHD are significantly less likely to graduate from high school. So in trying to sum up here in a few minutes, the conclusion is that if a child can't see that well, they're not going to be able to learn basic literacy skills and distinguish B's and P's and D's and Q's. And, you know, learning how to read in itself is hard enough for a 5 or 6 year old. If you don't get a good night's sleep, it's harder to learn. It's harder to pay attention. If you're going to not in school because you become pregnant, your chances of living a life in poverty are going to be magnified. If you go to a school characterized by aggression and violence, you're not connected. You're disengaged. You want to get away from there. You don't want to be there. If you're hungry when you go to school, and tragically in the United States, many children go to school hungry, it's going to be much harder for them to pay attention and learn to their fullest. And if you can't pay attention, you can't learn. One of the most important things I want to leave you with this morning is the way our whole research infrastructure is set up, the way our training programs, our policies are set up, they're all categorical. So we have people doing violence programs and sex education programs and food programs and these disparate programs. But that, when you look at the evaluations of the programs, you don't see large and consistent effects. That's because there's synergistic and interaction effects between these multiple factors. So we need programs that address a set of these factors simultaneously. And until we do that, we're not going to achieve the potential we have. And in summing up, I just say, you know, this siloed approach that we've had so far to trying to cultivate the next generation of Americans is not really working very well. It's really jeopardizing our future as a nation, not only our education and health sectors, but our overall vitality of American democracy. And we're going to have to break these silos down, and even the silos within the silos, as we move forward. And I'm glad to see that Secretary Coe is here. I can tell for sure that he's a big supporter of that. We need to engage the education sector to a greater degree and get them on board to a much greater degree for this agenda. And thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. Let me turn on my mic, because I'm here to represent the education sector that we've been talking about. Not, I totally fundamentally agree. I'm also here under this great challenge, you know, in the City of Champions, where I'm pinch hitting for a home run hitter. So I'm hopeful that I'll be able to at least give you a single. But I concur with everything that my colleagues on the panel have said thus far following Secretary Coe. I represent those schools in America where we see these disparities. My organization, the Coalition of Schools Educating Boys of Color, by its very name, tells you what we do. And all of the factors and forces and trends that were outlined, what we see every day in these schools. Now, I just want to begin my few remarks by just citing even what the President Barack Obama, said on July 19th, when he said, "I could have been Trayvon Martin." And he went on to say a couple of points that I thought loom large. And one of those questions or statements was, are we as a nation ready to demonstrate and show our black boys, and go for our black and brown boys, how much we really care about them? Are we ready to show them that there are pathways to success available to them? And then he said, we need to examine those biases and those things that get in the way. Now, being a lifelong educator and working with school systems across this country where I see these disparities and I see that health matters, I see the huge disconnection between what we're talking about and what is being practiced. And I'm ready to say that I'm glad I was asked, because it's given me an opportunity as a national spokesperson for schools across this country. Just prior to coming here, I was at the Council of Great City Schools, which represents the 66 largest urban school districts in this country, many of whom represent these dropout factories or these push-out factories. I work in the City of Jackson, Mississippi, which has specifically a 28% graduation rate of African-American boys, thus below horrendous. And I could certainly see going to Mississippi where all of these health issues, anyone here from Mississippi today? Okay, then all of these health issues loom critically large in that state. And one of the things that we haven't done well in the education sector is connect these dots. But I would put the charge out to the public health and education, the public health community, to reach in a different way to schools. Now, I think I'm pretty well read and learned as a former teacher, former principal, leader of a national organization, and I did not know until I was asked about Healthy 2020. Now, I've read it since then, and I see where many of the things in the Affordable Care Act and Healthy 2020 will greatly benefit the young people that I represent. And the issue of mental wellness and mental health is huge for black boys. It's huge. The suicide rate is rising. And for me now to know that there are avenues, there are pathways, then it's incumbent upon me as a national leader to help to reach out. But I would say that's reciprocal. I think we do just need another and a new and a more robust way of reaching out together to partner. Because what we see at stake here is the lives of young people who are, as I said, disconnected and disengaged from school, who are fueling the cradle to prison pipeline at an early age, because I will submit to you, as the Schott Foundation said in this report in 2007, we're seeing expulsions at the early childhood rate. We're seeing kids being pushed out, little black boys and brown boys being pushed out in preschool and commensurately given the label of at risk. And as the National Black Child Institute said, when you get that term at risk at an early age, it's almost like somebody telling you you've won the least likely to succeed in life award. And so we know that those variables around health, coming to school well-fed, coming to school being able to see, coming to school where you can breathe, coming to school where you are able to enjoy physical activity, is something that's not afforded to all of our young people, particularly those young people in poverty situations. Now, in public education, and I can speak from that realm that, as Dr. Balfance has underscored, you know, we have many issues that get in the way of learning, poverty being one of them, the low literacy rates. You know, if our parents are having trouble reading and being home teachers, it usually spills over into our young people. We're seeing overrepresentation in special education because when in doubt about a young person's ability to succeed in school in sort of the traditional ways, we refer them. And so you see the pipeline of special education is huge. And special education, 94, 166, 142, was never meant to be a lifelong sentence. It's meant to be something that will ameliorate some conditions for a young person. And on the flip side, you see an underrepresentation in gifted and talented. And we do know that our students of color have talent, gifts, assets, and plenty of resilience. And, you know, if they have the access to the health in the way they should in the health community within a school setting, I'm a huge advocate for in-school clinics, that will go a long way. We also know that these young people often are graced with the least prepared teachers. Not necessarily those who aren't passionate about the field, but the least prepared working with the group that needs the best, most prepared. It's just similar if I was going to my primary care physician, I have access to choice. So if I see that it's a doctor, primary health care physician that doesn't fit my needs, I also have enough wisdom to ask questions. And he might not be the person for me because I want the best physician I can get. So when you have teachers who are not necessarily the best, they may be willing, but not necessarily the most prepared, that enhances and increases, I think, some of the stubborn, perplexing issues that we are in now. I'd also say that in certain schools, too many schools across this country, there's a culture of low expectations. So I don't expect them, because they come from poverty, because the parents come from a fractured home, and low literacy rates, I can't expect them. I'm going to give them some love, but I can't expect them to achieve. Well, I'll quote one of the greatest educators who's still living today, Dr. Lorraine Monroe, in her book, Nothing's Impossible, where she said, but you know, teacher, you're not teaching that parent. You're teaching that young person. So regardless of whether the parent's incarcerated, regardless of whether the parent has low literacy rates, what does that have to do with the way you should be teaching that young person? This is particularly, this whole issue, this urgency around the health care and the connection to graduation is huge for Black and Latino boys, because that's where we're seeing the greatest drop-off, the greatest number of young people being left along the way, being left behind, are this population. So, you know, it's important that we begin to marshal our resources to connect the dots. There's a program in New York, for those of you who are New Yorkers that I consult into, it's called the Expanded Success Initiative, where Foundation and Department of Education have come together to put resources behind looking at 40 high schools and what they need to do to connect the dots to ensure that we have increased graduation. And so they're really looking at this academic sphere in a different way, school culture, and what happens after school. So because we know that those three elements, academic, the culture, and what happens after school hours, connecting all will make a difference. So what can we do? What are some of the strategies that we've been using as an organization? Number one, we have developed, and you can see it on our website, a set of standards called Standards and Promising Practices for Schools Educating Boys of Color. Standards and Promising Practices for Schools Educating Boys of Color. Our website, for those who have their laptops, www.cosboc, which is an acronym for Coalition of Schools Educating Boys of Color, COSEBOC. But what we're trying to say there, that in addition to The language of the land in the academic sphere is the common core. As one of the panelists said, the emphasis on the academic pursuit in America now is gravely important and huge for a lot of reasons. But I would submit to you what's absent is what I call the uncommon core, which are those things such as health and wellness and stability and stress reduction that we need to be paying more attention to. Now, while the common core is the imperative, that if we don't have healthy kids coming to school well and well-fed and mentally sound and feeling safe, then they won't ever get to the benchmarks we set in the common core. So that's another area of advocacy that I can easily see the public health community aligning with the enlightened members of the education community, such as the Council of Great City Schools, to form a new advance that says, yes, the common core is important, but the other core is equally essential. Because if we can't have that working for our kids just won't excel as we know they can. In Philadelphia, my home city, so when Dr. Bowell fans put that up, I immediately turn. We have a program. Its program is called Sankofa Passages. Sankofa. Sankofa is West African for, in order to go forward, you must reach back. We're working with 8 high schools, 250 young men. We're working where they have 4 adults with them all day. Now, these high school young men are the students who are in that category. They are the overage. They are the potential dropouts. They are the ones who are marginalized the most. Nothing wrong with their intelligence in many cases, but they've been disengaged from school. So Sankofa program is designed to do the following. It's designed to couple the academic rigor and preparation for post-secondary pursuits, along with the connection to one's culture and heritage. So the other, and I would say this is a health matter, it's unhealthy not to know who you are. It's unhealthy not to understand that there's a culture of greatness that you, black boy or Latino boy, stand upon. So what this program does is to connect and link the academic rigor with the cultural essentials. And in addition to that, in every school, there's probably about 50 boys per cohort in these high schools, thereabouts. They also have morning rituals that include these affirmations. They have a morning regular breakfast program. They have enrichment programs that travel to colleges and museums and things that their universe would not likely see. But I just cite this program as one model that clearly we could easily, and I know I would personally take it upon myself to integrate the health connections. And so I guess I'm speaking on behalf of a large community of urban educators that are looking for partnerships, and I will take it upon myself to do that. Thank you.